Jean Hurst versus Spirit World Bundle Company will hear argument from the petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Joe K. Longley will argue for petitioner.
May it please the court, counsel. Members of the court, I represent Ms. Emma Jean Hurst, who is the consumer petitioner in this particular case. This case involves the purchase of a heating and cooling unit from Sears Roebuck & Company back in June of 1975. And the factual development of the case was that after the, or in connection with the purchase of the heating unit from Sears, Ms. Hurst was told by the representative of Sears, Mr. Grimmick, that he would see to it that an inspection and permit was obtained from the city of Fort Worth in order to make sure that the heating unit was properly installed. It's uncontroverted that that indeed that inspection and permit was not obtained, and in April of 1977 there occurred some soot and smoke damage to her house, which she alleged came from an improper installation of this heating and cooling unit. And also she suffered some physical injuries in terms of some stomach aches, some headaches, coughing spells that she testified directly resulted from the smoke and soot that was in her house, which in turn resulted from the improper installation of the heating and cooling units which she had purchased from Sears. She alleged that the failure of the Sears Roebuck Company to get the inspection and permit was a producing cause of her case. And indeed, all of the issues were found in her favor at the trial court. It was found that the there was not an inspection done, nor was there a permit obtained as far as the installation of the heating and cooling unit. The testimony was further that surely there would have been, the unit would not have been approved for installation had there been such an inspection, because the combustion hole that is required is a necessary standard under the Fort Worth Code, building code, that would obviously have mandated that the installation in the form that it was installed not be passed for inspection. So this is the facts of the case as it comes to the court. The trial court granted judgment on the verdict. I mentioned all issues were found in favor of the plaintiff. Entered a judgment for treble damages under the Deceptive Trade Practices version that was in effect in 1977, which, as the court may know, it has been changed to where there is no longer mandatory treble damages since that time, but the version of the act that was in effect did mandate treble damages. And the court rendered its judgment for three times the amount of actual damages that were found by the jury. The case was appealed. Before I get to the appellate part of the statement of facts, I would like to point out that the trial court did deny attorney's fees, an action which we do take issue with and which is before this court also. It denied attorney's fees on the basis that there was not a proper submission of the proper elements under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act to award attorney's fees. And we have, I think, adequately briefed that point in our brief. I will discuss it as part of our point of error number four, which the court has granted the writ on later in my argument. The case was appealed to the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, where Justices Holman, Spurlock, and Massey were the panel that sat and heard the case. The Court of Appeals reversed and remanded the case, holding that a failure to do that which you said you would do cannot be an unconscionable act where it's shown that it's illegal to do it, or if it was impossible to do it. That was the ruling that the court had with regard to the unconscionability issue in the case. Further, the Court of Appeals held that there was no specific violation of Section 1746B that was submitted. Therefore, the plaintiff needed to submit a finding that the failure to secure the inspection and the permit was a deceptive trade practice. And the respondent cited in support of that proposition, the court's standard set forth in Spradlin versus Williams, a Supreme Court case of some years back, under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The court did not reach the question of attorney's fees, and that issue is before this court at this time. We filed our motion for rehearing. The court did write an opinion on motion for rehearing, clearing up a couple of points, and then we it overruled our motion for rehearing, and this case now finds itself before this honorable court which we submit has jurisdiction over the subject matter under the items which have set, we have set forth in accordance with Article 1728 of the Texas Revised Civil Statutes. Specifically, Your Honors, we contend that indeed there was unconscionable conduct as was found by the jury, and that was a producing cause of the damages sustained by Ms. Hurst. The evidence was uncontroverted that the defendant had failed to obtain the necessary permit and the inspection. Moreover, in the transcript, page 27, you'll find that the defendant did not plead affirmative defenses of either illegality or impossibility of performance. So there were no pleadings on those two points. Yet the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth utilized the defenses of impossibility of performance and illegality in its reasoning to find that there was no unconscionable action or course of action here. And that was raised for the first time in any pleading. In fact, it was never raised in any pleading I could find, but the Fort Worth Court of Appeals used that theory for the basis of its finding that this could not be unconscionable conduct. And it was, in my perspective, an unusual method of reaching the result that they did, for the point that they make a distinction between if you misrepresent that you can do something which it is impossible for you to do, they distinguish that kind of conduct from a failure to do that which you have said you would do. As we have pointed out in our brief, to me at least, in my perspective, this is a distinction without a difference. Because on the one hand, you're failing to do that which you said you would do, and even if it's impossible for you to do, which we submit it was not impossible for Sears to obtain an inspection and a permit, it clearly could delegate that duty to someone who had the ability to obtain those items. In fact, it thought it had. It just didn't check on it to make sure that was done. But this distinction that is utilized by the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth is really a distinction that has no difference. There is no requirement that there be a representation or a misrepresentation under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act for there to be unconscionable conduct. As the Court well knows, Section 17.45, Subsection 5 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, states that unconscionable conduct is that type of action, act, or practice which to a person's detriment results takes advantage of a person's lack of knowledge, ability, experience, or capacity to a grossly unfair degree. And that was the exact issue that was pled. That was the exact issue that was submitted to the jury in this case. The jury found that indeed the failure to obtain the necessary permit and inspection was an unconscionable act or practice, and it also found that that was a producing cause of the damages, if any, sustained by the plaintiff. So there is really, the court below seems obsessed with the proposition that there has to be some misrepresentation to find unconscionable conduct. And one only needs to look at the cases to find that that is not the case. Certainly there must be a misrepresentation if you're going under one of the laundry list items, because there the legislature has mandated certain specific types of conduct constitute per se violations of the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, one of which is representing that goods or services are of a particular quality, standard, or grade when they are of another. This is another item that we pled and was submitted in Special Issue Number 3, which the court below disagreed with us that did submit a laundry list violation. I'll get to that in just a moment. But the laundry list, Section 17.46 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, is where you find the requirement for representations or misrepresentation. You do not find that same requirement either for a breach of warranty or for unconscionable conduct, which are defined in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, just as I had mentioned under Section 17.45, Subsection 5. This unconscionable conduct really encompasses the idea of unfairness. It takes advantage of someone's lack of ability, knowledge, experience, or capacity to a grossly unfair degree. How could Ms. Imogene Hurst know that Sears Roebuck & Company wasn't licensed to get the inspection or the permit unless she was told, which is uncontroversial, she's not told that? How could she possibly do anything about it when she's having to rely upon the representations of a Sears salesman? And this did take advantage of her lack of knowledge, her ability, her experience, and her capacity to a grossly unfair degree. The evidence is completely overwhelming, and I submit uncontroverted on this point.
As I recall, neither Sears had the license, nor the subcontractor they obtained had a license to do this work.
That is correct, Your Honor.
No dispute about it was done improperly.
No dispute that it was done improperly and that there was no inspection nor permit taken out. Indeed, the gentleman who did the installation admitted that the city of Fort Worth would not have passed this inspection had it seen the way it was installed, that there was no combustion hole cut for the gas and the soot to circulate. And this would cause exactly what happened here, smoke and soot to back up in the house and possibly cause problems either through property damage or personal injury, which it did in this particular case. So later, there was evidence that Sears came in and fixed this after the occurrence in question. Pardon me. In any event, clearly this was unconscionable conduct, and it does not require a representation, although we submit to this court that there was a representation by Mr. Grimmett that he would get the inspection and get the proper permit. And the jury so found and answered to special issue number 3 and found that that was a producing cause of the damages, if any. That goes to our third point of error, but I'm still discussing here the unconscionability approach that the Court of Appeals took. I submit, members of the court, that the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth simply missed the point about what constitutes unconscionability. And I don't say this in any demeaning fashion, because unconscionability is a separate theory of recovery under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. As this court well knows from the many cases that you have written on, there are 4 causes of action, one of which is the concept of deceptive trade practice, which is found in 17.50A1. And then the concept of breach of implied or express warranty, which is A2. The concept of unconscionable action or course of action, which is A3. And then finally, any violation of Article 21.21 of the Texas Insurance Code or any of the rules or regulations promulgated by the State Board of Insurance pursuant to that article. So there are 4 distinct causes of action. And I submit that the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth perhaps confused unconscionability with the requirement of misrepresentation that may be required in the individual items of the so-called laundry list of violations that are contained in Section 17.46. But be that as it may, there were clear findings on it. The evidence was overwhelming and uncontroverted that this caused the damage, and the trial court was correct, in my perspective, in rendering the judgment based upon the verdict. The point that I wish to raise is that, likewise, the Court of Appeals did not really give a liberal construction to the term of unconscionability, which this court has consistently done, and I have pointed out in the briefing, Smith versus Baldwin at 611 Southwest 2nd 611, this court's case involving a very, very similar fact situation where a builder failed to obtain a VA inspection report. Almost the exact same facts. It was held there. That was a violation of the laundry list violation of Section 17.46B7, that they did not meet the standards of the VA. Here we make the same allegation that they did not meet the standards of the city code in Fort Worth. This is under our third point of error, which I'll reach in a moment. But that case, Smith versus Baldwin, of course mandates that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is to be given a liberal construction to promote its underlying purposes, and this is the exact language of the statute. There's no need for this court to look to the legislative history of the Consumer Protection Act as to how it's to be interpreted, because the legislature, in its wisdom, put in a construction and application provision that said this can be liberally construed to promote its underlying purposes, which are to protect consumers against false, misleading, and deceptive action practices, breaches of warranty, and unconscionable actions. So we submit that the court below erred in applying erroneous rules of law to reach the result that it did on the unconscionability portion of this case. It did not give a liberal interpretation to the terms that are set forth clearly in the statute, and we feel that at a very minimum the case should be sent back if the Court of Appeals is not reversed and the trial court affirmed, that it should at least be sent back for an opinion and hearing not inconsistent with the proper rules which should be set forth by this court, just as it has in Smith versus Baldwin, and the other many cases that this court has ruled on involving the construction of the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, which I might add, the court has been completely consistent in each and every one of those cases to carry out the mandate of the legislature, which was to give a liberal construction to the wording of the act in order to protect consumers. Now, another point I have to raise in connection with the court's ruling on unconscionability. The court uses the defenses of illegality and impossibility of performance to reach its conclusion that where you have an impossibility of performance, and here the court went off on the fact that Sears was not a licensed contractor, therefore it was impossible for Sears to get the necessary permit or inspection, or that if Sears did do it, it would have been illegal for Sears to do it because they were not a licensed contractor. This misses the point for a couple of reasons. Number one, these are contract defenses. This is not a contract case. This is a case brought under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, just as Smith against Baldwin was brought. These contract defenses simply do not apply in a Deceptive Trade Practices Act case, as this court has so held in Smith against Baldwin. Those common law defenses were not codified in the code. And I could certainly point to the, I believe it's page 616 of Smith against Baldwin, where this court has said that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act does not represent a codification of the common law. And a primary purpose of the enactment of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act was to provide consumers a cause of action for deceptive trade practices without the burden of proof and numerous defenses encountered in a common law fraud or breach of warranty suit. And again, this same principle applies here because, as the court may recall in Smith against Baldwin, the respondent there was trying to impose a defense that was not in the statute relating to substantial performance. Here, the respondent is attempting to impose defenses of illegality and impossibility where none are provided in the statute. But moreover, there's no pleadings of either one of those affirmative defenses. And we submit that, of course, they were not tried by consent, and that these were only raised in the Court of Appeals opinion, we feel, as a fait accompli to reach the result that they did, which we feel applied erroneous rules of law, clearly in conflict with this court's opinion of Smith against Baldwin. Moving along, the the cases that have been decided on unconscionability clearly show that there is no requirement of any type of representation or misrepresentation for there to be unconscionable conduct. Unconscionable conduct can constitute almost any conceivable thing that might take unfair advantage of a person's lack of ability, knowledge, experience, or capacity. And likewise, even the statute says in the subsection 2 of unconscionability that if the transaction results in a gross disparity between the value of the thing received and the consideration paid, that is defined as unconscionability. So just merely the taking advantage of a person by charging too much money, by overreaching, has nothing to do with misrepresentation. Just the simple unfairness of those acts have been recognized. And I would direct the court's attention to Franks against Associated Air Center, which is cited in the brief, a recent case involving a non-representation type of finding on unconscionability. We simply submit that the Court of Appeals was confused. It mixed the two elements that are separate and distinct under the Act, which are deceptive trade practice and unconscionability, and required in the unconscionability portion of its holdings that there be some type of misrepresentation, which is just simply not the law, and as this court and the other courts cited in the brief have so held. I would like to move along very briefly to our third point of error. Special issue number 3 that was submitted, another, again, all of these findings were found in favor of the plaintiff, but special issue number 3 stated that it inquired, did defendant's representative, Grimmett, tell plaintiff before the work began that the defendant would secure a permit from the City of Fort Worth to install the heating and cooling unit in her home and would get the work inspected by city inspectors, to which the jury answered yes. The jury also answered in response to the next issue, that that was a producing cause of the damages, if any, which he sustained. And the Court of Appeals, again, I feel missed the boat on this particular issue because it held that, the issue that was submitted did not actually submit a 17.46B7 violation, which was the pleadings. In this particular case, the plaintiff had pled, and this is on page 6 of the transcript, that the defendant represented that the unit would be installed in accordance with the standards of the City of Fort Worth codes, when in fact no permit was taken out nor final inspection procured. Such representation violated section 17.46B7. So there was specific pleading, and this issue was an attempt to submit the 17.46B7 violation for determination of the jury. Now, the court said, the court below stated that there was no that this really did not submit a specific violation under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. It really did not submit a 17.46B7 violation. The court may remember that 17.46B7 states that it is a deceptive trade practice to represent that goods or services are of a particular quality, standard, or grade when they are of another. Here we have specific pleadings that they did not meet the standards of the city code, and that was what the plaintiff was intending to submit with this issue. Admittedly, the issue could have been worded better. However, we submit, as our first proposition under our third point of error, that this did in fact submit a 17.46B7 violation. Indeed, the objections that were made by the counsel for the defendant recognize this fact, and if I may indulge the court for a moment, I brought along an exhibit from the transcript which shows the objection that was made to special issue number 3. And you will see that in subsection D of the defendant's objections, the objection was that such representation, if made by Mr. Grimmett, was not such as to come under section 17.46.7 under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act as being a representation that they were of a particular style, model or standard quality or grade. This was the objection that was made. Clearly, the defendant was able to discern that what was being made here, what was being submitted pursuant to the rules, was an inquiry concerning 17.46.7. If the defendant did not understand that, I have to ask then why this objection to the charge? Why was the defendant making the objection that this does not come under 17.46B7? We submit that it does. We submit that the case was submitted on that theory, and there was a finding on that. Clearly, the defendant had no problem agreeing that we were trying to submit it under that particular section. By the way, defendant's objection number 3 to the court's charge remains the same for special issue number 3, 4, and 5. And these are the operative deceptive trade practice findings. The defendant submitted the same objection to all three issues. Special issue number 4 was a producing cause issue. Special issue number 5 was the unconscionability issue. This objection was not made to the producing cause trailer issue to special issue number 5, which inquired as to unconscionability. I have to point out that it's just a simple difference of opinion. Rule 274, 279, the requirements of submitting these issues, and of course this court's opinion in American, Judge Campbell's opinion in Brown versus American Transfer and Storage, requires that you only submit the issues in as close of language as you can to the statute, but that you do submit, try to submit the issues in the language of the statute. We submit that this gets close enough. And even if it doesn't get close enough, Your Honors, we submit that there was no objection. No, you find no objection here to the wording of the issue, that it's in an improper form or an improper wording. And Rule 274 certainly requires a distinct objection if there is such, if there's going to be an objection made as to the wording of an issue. It's not in the proper form or it's not in the wording of the statute. Clearly, that's required under Rule 274 that someone at some time point that out. And this is the objection to that particular issue, and it is not found there. Moreover, the Court of Appeals went on to say that since it decided that this was not a laundry list or a per se violation submitted, there was a requirement, as this court has certainly held in Spradlin against Williams. I believe Judge Pope wrote that opinion, if I recall it correctly, that where you do not have a laundry list violation, where it is not a per se violation, you must find that the conduct is deceptive. And the Court of Appeals below held that that was a required element here because the issue that was submitted did not submit a laundry list violation. So we are faced then with, if the Court of Appeals requires a finding that the act of failing to obtain a permit or the representation that he would obtain a permit and inspection and he did not do so, if the Court of Appeals requires a separate finding as to whether or not that was a deceptive trade practice, we contend then under Rule 279, that would require an objection for its failure to appear in the charge. Clearly under Rule 279, there is the burden on the defendant where an element, where an issue or a theory of recovery requires more than one submission to come forward and object that an element is lacking. And here the evidence was overwhelming that this was a deceptive trade practice. Where there is no objection, and where there is evidence to support the issue, had it been submitted, Rule 279 mandates, as this court well knows, that of course it is deemed found in favor of the judgment. And we submit that even if this court should decide that the issue that was submitted did not submit a laundry list violation, and even if this court decides that that perhaps there was some type of objection in this objection that you find before you hear, that it was not in the proper wording of the statute, then the court would have to come to the conclusion under Rule 279 that there was clearly no objection as to a missing element. We find no objection here that there is an element missing from recovery on a deceptive trade practice claim. It's just not there. And Rule 279 clearly shows that an objection like that must be made. And the evidence, I'll not bore the court with the evidence, but clearly there was evidence that Ms. Imogene Hirst relied upon the representation that was made to her. It turned out to be false. It was uncontroverted it was false. Not even the independent contractor got the inspection and the permit, as has already been pointed out. And certainly it can be inferred for the purpose of deeming an issue found under Rule 279 that this evidence supported that omitted finding. I also would point out to the court a very recent case. It is cited in the brief, but I must at least bring it up. It's Prairie Cattle Company against Fletcher. And it is the exact holding where there was, and if I may indulge the court, the Prairie objected to the court's charge on numerous grounds. We do not find, however, an objection to the failure to submit an issue inquiring whether the act inquired about in special issue number one is a deceptive trade practice. Just as here you find no objection that there is a lack of an issue inquiring as to a deceptive trade practice. And then they quote Rule 279, and the court goes on to hold that since no objection was made to its omission, however, and there is evidence to support a finding, that act was a deceptive trade practice. We must deem it found by the trial court, and he quotes from Rule 279, in such manner as to support the judgment under the clear language of Rule 279. And so even if the court should somehow determine that there was not a per se submission here in this particular case with special issue number three, it clearly must be deemed found in support of the judgment in the clear light of the evidence and in the clear, undisputed light that there's no objection made to an omitted finding. Finally, Your Honors, the attorney's fees issue has resulted in the fact that the trial court did not grant the attorney's fees that were found by the jury. The issue was submitted as to reasonable. The defendant objected that there should be an issue submitted as to whether or not attorney's fees are reasonable and necessary. I submit to the court that the element of necessariness of attorney's fees was only put in the statute in 1979. The court may recall that Section 9 of Senate Bill 357 required only prospective application of those amendments. And the trial court just simply erred in not rendering the attorney's fees because this was an old act case. Admittedly, I see my time is up, and I'll just rely upon my brief for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Mr. Gerald Walker will argue for respondent.
Members of the Court, this suit grew out of a representation by my client's representative, a salesman, that an installation permit would be issued by the City of Fort Worth, and the City of Fort Worth would make an inspection. Now, when that representation was made, the petitioner and the respondent sat down immediately and entered into a written contract whereby the installation would be performed by an independent contractor qualified and licensed by the City of Fort Worth, and that Sears Roebuck would have nothing to do with the installation. Now, some question was asked whether or not this independent contractor was actually licensed, and the Court, I believe, was told that he was not licensed. He was licensed. He had been not only licensed by the City of Fort Worth, he was licensed by the state of Texas, at least in part, but the actual licensing, the qualification, was by the City of Fort Worth, whereby the City of Fort Worth would post a list of qualified independent contractors, and Sears Roebuck and Company had to use one of those individuals. Could not do its own work and did not attempt to. Some question was asked by the court as to whether or not Sears, or at least it was represented that Sears came back and made the repairs. Sears had nothing to do with the repairs. Another licensed independent contractor made the repairs. Independent contractor that was assigned to this job made the installation, but he did not take out the permit and did not call for a city inspection. There's really serious question whether or not that was even important, for the reason that after the smoke damage, the city could not find the cause of the smoke, the soot, until the inspector could not, until it was pointed out at least there was a board missing from the closet in which the installation was made. Now, the board missing and the lining of the closet, all of that obligation under the written contract fell on the petitioner, not on Sears Roebuck, and not on the independent contractor. But that board missing was not found until some 2.5 years after the installation. As a matter of fact, the smoke, the soot, did not occur until almost 2 years after the installation. I think that a jury could have, if it had been properly submitted, could have found that there could have been any number of causes of the smoking other than the installation. Now, the independent contractor was not made a party to this suit. All right. The respondent contends in this case that this cause of action was not properly submitted in the trial court. Special issue number 3 merely established that the salesman represented that a permit would be taken out and the city's inspection made. And that was complied with when the parties entered into a written contract whereby both agreed that the installation would be made by someone licensed and qualified by the City of Fort Worth, and it was his duty. As a matter of fact, he was the only entity the only one that could have taken out a permit and could have called for city inspection. There was no submission as to whether or not such representation was deceptive, and the Court of Appeals held that since it was not deceptive, since it was not a per se violation of the laundry list, the verdict was defective and would not support a judgment. And for that reason, the trial judgment was reversed and remanded for new trial. Now, may I talk with you a moment about point number four, which deals with attorney's fees. The trial court intended that he would submit the attorney's fees under the statute which was appropriate at the time of the trial, to the effect that the legal services were both necessary and reasonable. That was his intention.
How do you know that was the trial court's intent?
He told us that, John.
Is it in the record?
It's in the record in response to the respondent's motion for judgment. And in that, he announced that he admitted that he erred in leaving the word out of the word necessary out of the submission. Now, it was an inadvertent leaving out, but it nevertheless it was out, and the respondent objected to the charge in that respect at that time, but the court apparently overlooked that or thought it was in there, and after the jury had been dismissed and the respondent made a motion for judgment, then the trial court admitted that he erred and would not include the attorney's fees in the judgment. Now, there's something said, and I think in the petitioner's brief or the supplemental brief, to the effect that there was a motion filed by the petitioner for judgment. Well, let me comment on that. It is the respondent's contention that the petitioner waived any objection relating to attorney's fees because there was no objection made by the petitioner in the manner in which the trial court submitted this to the jury and leaving out the word necessary. There was absolutely no request by the petitioner in a particular form of submission. No requested special issue was requested. There was no motion for judgment presented by the petitioner for attorney's fees in the judgment. As a matter of fact, the petitioner filed a motion for judgment, but never presented it to the court. The only motion for judgment that was presented to the court was that of the respondent.
Counsel, why should he have objected to the issue as omitting an element that he didn't believe belonged in there?
Well, I think that he should have brought it to the attention of the court.
But he thought the issue was correct, as I understood this record, and thinks it is correct now.
Well,
why should he be assuming the burden of filing some objection to an issue he thought was correct then and does now?
I think then that if the court feels that that is the situation, then I think the petitioner at least had a burden to file a motion for judgment on that point, which the petitioner waived by not presenting that point after the verdict was received by the court. There was no bill of exception. There was no motion for judgment. It was absolutely, the record is vacant. And I might tell you the conversation was vacant too. Now, there were a number of cross points which the respondents preserved in the Court of Appeals, which were not acted on by the court, and I think should have been. The Deceptive Trade Practices Act provides that a consumer may maintain a cause of action for damages if he has been adversely affected. Now, whether a consumer has been adversely affected constitutes an ultimate fact issue. The trial court made no submission to the jury as to whether or not the petitioner had been adversely affected. And that was objected to by the respondent. Now, while it may be argued in the brief by the petitioner that that's not necessary, I think it is, because the damages that the petitioner claims she sustained do not establish who or what caused such adverse effect. Now, from the evidence before the jury, the question was the adverse effect caused by the petitioner's space heater. Now, at the foot of her bed, she had a space heater, an open space heater, that was very close to the bed clothing, and there was evidence that the at least to raise by inference that the bed clothing could have smoldered, or wearing apparel could have smoldered, because in this large house, seven-room house, her room, where the space heater was, had more soot deposit than all of the rest of the house put together. Now, the jury could have, if that had been submitted as to whether or not she had been adversely affected by the space heater or anything else, could have found that it was not caused by the installation. From the evidence before the jury, there was ample evidence that the petitioner had two adult sons that would frequently sit up late at night and watch television and fall asleep smoking and dropping cigarettes. One of those sons, the evidence showed, that would frequently come home and after he had been drinking would suffer seizures while watching TV. I think that the jury could have, if it had been submitted to the jury, could have found that if she had been, the petitioner had been adversely affected, could have been from any one of those.
Did you request me on this?
I did not, but I objected to the, I approached it from another angle. I objected to the charge because it did not submit the statutory requirement whether or not the petitioner had been adversely affected. Now, there was a plain assumption, as far as I can tell, that the central heating unit caused the smoke. But from where the unit was supposed to have smoked, there wasn't absolutely any accumulation of soot, just as clean as it could be. And in the closet, there was no soot any place. The damages in this case of soot accumulation do not establish that the petitioner was adversely affected by the independent contractor nor by the respondent. And question, do we presume that the petitioner was adversely affected? And if we do presume that she was adversely affected, do we put on top of that presumption one that it was the respondent that caused the adverse effect? The petitioner had the burden to establish a causal link between the respondent and the damages. I don't think she did that, because quoting directly from Mr. Longley's book on this subject, quote, the causal link necessary to establish a cause of action under the Act is referred to by the term adversely affected. This causal link, unquote, this causal link is statutory as far as I can determine, and I think the trial court erred in not submitting to the jury a question as to whether or not the petitioner was adversely affected by the statement of Mr. Grimmett, the salesman. The Court of Appeals should have written on these cross points, but did not. Now, respondent preserved another cross point relating to damages, which was not acted on by the Court of Appeals. In this case, the trial court awarded the petitioner treble damages for physical pain and suffering. There was no submission as to whether or not the petitioner sustained any physical injury. There was no apparent physical injury. There was no obvious, no objective signs of physical injury. She said that she got up in the morning, the house, her room was full of smoke, and for a while she just pulled the cover back over her head and stayed in bed. But then she says she got up and she never left that house from about 8 or 8:30 in the morning until 4 that afternoon when she went to work. Never got out in the fresh air at any time. Missed no work, worked as usual, never went to a doctor, never consulted the doctor, never took any medication. And there, as far as I can determine, there is absolutely no accompanying physical injury in this case. And what the court did was, he merely submitted the question, how much for physical pain and suffering. He made no independent submission as to whether or not there was any physical injury. And the cross points constitute objections because there's no evidence of physical injury, insufficient evidence of physical injury, which was not ruled on by the Court of Appeals. There was no submission as to whether the petitioner had any physical injury, no submission as to whether or not the petitioner was adversely affected. And then we contend in a cross point that the damages found by the jury were manifestly too great, $10,000. And we contend that the treble damages were not applicable because not accompanied by physical injury. Now, we think the Court of Appeals should have written on this point, and I think that the suit should be remanded either to the Court of Appeals for consideration on cross points or to the trial court for new trial. Now, gentlemen, the decision by the Court of Appeals does not violate your ruling in Smith versus Baldwin, contrary to the contention of the petitioner. While the Court of Appeals used one line in its entire opinion that it should not have used, that was not the basis for its reversal of the trial court and remand back for new trial. The opinion on rehearing explained that the petitioner had misread the court's opinion. Now, I submit to this court to do what you have done in countless cases where someone comes up and argues, well, here in this opinion, there is a line that's in our favor and we want the case reversed. What you have done many times, you say, well, let's don't look at one line. Let's take it from cover to cover. Let's look at from corner to corner. And when you do that, I think you will agree that the Court of Appeals did not violate Smith versus Baldwin. And I think if you will look at the written contract between the parties, the parties agreed that the burden of obtaining the building, the installation permit, and the inspection rested on the independent contractor, and that Sears Roebuck and Company, under the rules, the ordinances of the City of Fort Worth, had absolutely no control over the installation. And I think that there are some serious questions as to whether or not the petitioner was even adversely affected by the installation or the failure to get the permit and city inspection. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, counsel. Hear a response from the petitioner.
Thank you, members of the court. If it please the court, very briefly, I'll clear up a couple of what I consider to be misconceptions here. I did not state on opening that the independent contractor was not licensed. I did state that the licensed independent contractor did not procure the inspection or the permit, as neither did Sears. No one procured it. It was just simply not done. As to the attorney's fees, members of the court, I would direct the court's attention to page 80 of the transcript, and therein lies the ruling of the court on the attorney's fees. And the ruling is denying the respondent's motion for NOV, and it granted it except as to, it says it is according to order that the court that defendant's motion for judgment non obstante verdicto is hereby overruled, and then the court wrote in its handwriting, except as to question 8. Question 8 is the attorney's fees. So indeed there was a ruling on the attorney's fees issue, and indeed we still submit on behalf of Ms. Imogene Hurst that the attorney's fees issue was correct at the time of trial, just as it is correct today. And there is no requirement for counsel to submit an incorrect submission when the attorney's fees issue was correct. And again, counsel for Sears did not object to any type of wording being deficient in the issue. He simply objected that the words "and necessary," reasonable and necessary attorney's fees, were not included. And of course, that's not the standard under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act as it was situated in prior to 1979. The element of necessary attorney's fees only came into being after August 27, 1979. And so it's just simply not applicable here. And we would submit to the court, and we request the court to affirm the trial court, and in so doing, modify the trial court's judgment to grant the attorney's fees, including those all the way through the appeal to this honorable court. The law is just simply, mandates that that happens, in my view, and certainly in terms of a look at Section 9 of Senate Bill 357 and a look at the Deceptive Trade Practices Act as it existed prior to the enactment of those amendments. Now, quickly, I want to address the point that counsel made relating to adverse effect. Counsel read only a portion of the section from the book, which I'm privileged to have my name on, and that is that certainly adverse effect is the causal connection, but that adverse effect can be decided either through proximate cause or producing cause, just as it was found here. And indeed, the trial court went to great lengths to protect the record regarding what was submitted to the jury. Both the producing cause issues related to was the failure to secure a permit and the work inspected by city inspectors a producing cause of plaintiff damages, if any. That was special issue number 4. Special issue number 6, trailing the unconscionability issue. Was such action a producing cause of plaintiff damages, if any? Then, if that wasn't enough, the damages issue itself, the court was very strict in keeping the damages strictly to what happened here, in submitting the question of damages. What sum of money, if any, if paid now in cash, would fairly and reasonably compensate plaintiff for, and subsection C, for physical pain and suffering, if any? That is the standard by which this particular set of evidence should be judged. Moreover, as to the physical injury, the plaintiff testified that she initially suffered coughing spells. This is at volume 1 of the Statement of Facts, page 31, that there was fumes on the morning of the occasion in question that caused the coughing. She further testified that the smoke fumes made her sick, and her head and her stomach were hurting. She testified that the headaches continued for 2 or 3 months. There was testimony from more than one witness that improper combustion causes carbon monoxide and other noxious chemicals, and that the evidence shows that a burning rubber hose, such as the one found on the unit, will cause smoke. Each of these things we submit could have, and indeed, with reasonable inference from the evidence, did cause the physical injuries in question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Cause will be submitted on briefs and oral argument. We'll take a 10-minute recess.
All right.